For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Lord, now I'm really humbled. I needed it. Thank you for it, because this is you. And this is your book, and this is your message. This is your love letter, not only to the Israelites, but it's a love letter to all who read it. Now I'm grateful, God, for what you've given me, and I want to give it away. And I want people to see you in a new, fresh way as they deal with questions about you from the entire Bible, but especially in the Old Testament. So Jesus, you are the culmination of even Deuteronomy. And so we give you the praise, we give you the worship, we give you the glory, and we ask that your Spirit would teach us all something new and fresh and deep about who you are. And it's in your name that I'm going to pray. Amen. All right. So, you should have a handout of PowerPoint notes. Come on in. So I'm going to start off by asking you if you've ever heard anyone say statements like these three that are about to show up, or if you yourself have ever said them. Have you ever said, law is the Old Testament, but grace, that's the New Testament? Have you ever heard that? Ever thought that? How about the God in the Old Testament is different from the God of the New Testament? I was working on this last week, and a plumber was at our house, and we got to talk about God, and he said, yeah, I've read the Old Testament, the God of the Old Testament, he's different from the God of the New Testament. I said, oh, really? Let's talk. The Old Testament law has nothing of value for the New Testament Christian. So have you ever heard these ideas, thought these ideas? Well, the goal in the Summer Institute is apologetics, and I'm crafting this talk around the fact that you're going to hear these things both from non-Christians and from Christians, and you probably even think them yourselves. I think for a long time I stayed away from the Old Testament because that wasn't for me as a New Testament Christian. Now, I am going to say from the outset, the New Testament is where most of our time will be spent as New Testament Christians, but the Old Testament has plenty of information, not only for our heads, but for our hearts as well. And so we're going to look at how to dispel some of this, how to bring the two testaments together a little bit more, how to lessen this gap that I think for a lot of us as followers of Christ still hold about the Bible. And we're going to do that by looking at Deuteronomy's structure and two of Deuteronomy's themes. I'm taking 4 weeks of a class, and I'm smashing it into an hour. So there's a whole lot more. That's why I've created a four-part study. If you want to venture into studying Deuteronomy yourself, I'm giving you a four-part guided study that might help you learn even more about this book in the Old Testament. All right, but I want you to be able to speak confidently to those three questions. So we're going to look at God's grace and God's priorities in the book of Deuteronomy. All right, so how many of you have never read Deuteronomy really well enough to say you've read Deuteronomy? How many of you really don't know much about this book? All right, how many of you have read it a lot? Okay, all right, a couple experts, and you get to raise your hand. All right, well, I'm going to probably talk somewhere in the middle. I'm going to assume that you might have a working knowledge of Genesis, creation, fall, Exodus, Egypt, let my people go, right? Okay. All right. So that's, if you know that much, you're good to go. All right. First of all, Deuteronomy was written by Moses. So I'm going to give him the early date of 1440 BC. Deuteronomy is what's called a covenant renewal document. Covenant. A covenant is greater than a contract. Contract is 50-50. But a covenant is a binding commitment of love and loyalty, 100-100. And so this is a covenant document. And it's a renewal document. Deuteronomy is actually spoken to the second generation of Israelites that were out of Egypt. The first generation decided not to believe that God was trustworthy enough to go into the promised land. So God said, you guys don't get to go in, but your children do. So this is written 40 years later after, the Ten Commandments were given and the Mount of, Mount Sinai and all that. This is 40 years later. So it's a renewal document. And it's also, there's so many layers to look at this book, but the book of Deuteronomy is also Israel's national constitution. Here's a group of people that had been oppressed and imprisoned by Egypt for 400 years. All of a sudden, they're a nation. How do you govern yourself, right? And so God gives them, in a sense, a national constitution. And then in another base way, it's a land lease. God is giving them this land, and he's saying, if you generally follow this constitution I'm going to give you, you can stay in the land. The reason why I say that is, it's not a salvation document. You will not find verses about how to get saved personally in this book. And so they didn't have to be perfect to stay in the land, because this is not about salvation. I'm going to make that point probably a million times, or at least 1,000. But I think that's a confusion. When we read Deuteronomy, we think we're going to learn about salvation. No, no, no. It's a constitution, and it's a land lease, as well as being a covenant between two people, two groups. For years, generations, centuries, people thought that Deuteronomy was a primitive document, loosely organized with not a lot of flow, but that has really changed since archaeology became a pretty important science. Deuteronomy was written in the form of a suzerain vassal treaty. What is a suzerain vassal treaty? Well, it was a common document in the ancient Near Eastern world, where you had a suzerain, the great king, someone like Pharaoh. Pharaoh would go in and conquer a smaller king, a little king. And the suzerain had absolute right of sovereignty, demanded loyalty and service, aka love, and would pledge protection to the subjects in the realm. And in the book of Deuteronomy, the great suzerain is God. The vassal would be the subject king, and the vassal would pledge absolute loyalty to its suzerain, love, and it would enjoy the protection from the suzerain. And so in the book of Deuteronomy, in this document, Israel is the suzerain. And so this is the relationship that God wanted to have with the nation of Israel, where God, the great king, a good great king, would pledge protection and blessings to the vassal, Israel, who would in turn pledge loyalty and fidelity. And so this is, greater than a land lease, greater than a national constitution. This is a true relationship document as well. So this chart, which has been used for I don't know how many years, came from Biblical Archaeology Review. Anne gave me this I don't know how many years ago. And this is a chart of what's been discovered in archaeology for suzerain vassal documents, ancient Near Eastern treaties between, conquering kings and the little kings. And so it progresses from very early till now. Well, we've discovered that Deuteronomy was written in the late second millennium form of a suzerain vassal treaty. By the way, who wrote this? Moses. Where was he educated? Under whose tutelage? Pharaoh, a great suzerain, right? Wouldn't Moses have had the education to craft a document in this fashion? See how God works everything out for the good? But we're going to see Deuteronomy is shaped somewhat like this. Again, for the sake of time, I can't go through all these. Does it show up? Yeah, I'm not going to put my email address if you want me to send you the PowerPoint. But You're going to have the preamble, chapter 1, the historical prologue, the stipulations of the covenant, the great suzerain telling the vassal, these are the laws I want you to obey in love. Witnesses for other ancient Near Eastern cultures, the suzerain will call the gods to be witnesses. Well, who does God call, right? So he says, I call heaven and earth as your witnesses today. The ratification, the cursings and blessings. The cursings are absolutely expected by the vassal. So there's no surprise to Israel that there would be curses if they don't follow. And the curses that are listed in chapter 28 or 27 are what a vassal would expect. And then there's even farther than the suzerain vassal treaty organization, there's what's called a covenantal lawsuit. I can't pronounce it in the Hebrew word, but Moses' song is part of what a lawsuit that a suzerain would lodge against its vassal for its disloyalty, which Israel, of course, was. And so it's an incredibly organized document. Moreover, it's organized in a concentric form, where you have the outer frame, inner frame, inner court, and then it goes back out. And even chapters, chapter 8 is organized in a concentric form, A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A. I practiced that. So Deuteronomy was organized to be remembered. It was organized to be remembered. Deuteronomy is not a primitive document written by primitive people. It was ultimately authored by God, but it was written for the contemporary audience to understand, written by someone who was educated, probably in the house that wrote some of these. Cool already, huh? Yeah. All right, so one more thing about organization. So the Ten Commandments. What do we do with the Ten Commandments? Why am I putting them in the organization? Well, the word that we translate commandments is also the word, the ten words. And so scholars have begun to take a look at these and have deduced with some consensus that Deuteronomy's ten words can also be called ten chapter titles or ten thesis statements. So this chart comes from Walter Kaiser's Toward Old Testament Ethics, where, for example, the first and second commandment is followed in the covenant stipulations section of Deuteronomy in a general organized form. It's about worshiping God. When you have do the Sabbath, right? Thou shalt not, sorry, I have to do it, break the Sabbath, right? Don't break the Sabbath. Then this section is all about rest. Not only the Sabbath day, but the Sabbath year. And the Sabbath debt forgiveness and the Jubilee. It's all about rest. Now, other authors, other historians will make this a little bit looser. Like the gentleman that I read a lot from, Christopher Wright, he'll do it a little bit looser. But in general, the agreement is that even the Ten Commandments were organized to make Deuteronomy a readable document. Pretty cool, huh? Oh, have I said that? Yeah. All right. So, to sum up this first section of Deuteronomy's structure, Deuteronomy is a coherent, organized, thoughtful document worthy of linguistic, historical, and rhetorical respect. It is a well-written, well-organized document for the nation of Israel. God knew exactly what he was doing. All right, let me continue. Let's head over into the themes of grace and God's priorities. God's grace, you see a lot of it in chapters 5 through 11. Now remember, we all think that law is in the Old Testament and grace is in the New Testament. And some authors, unfortunately, I think facilitate that idea. Is there grace in the law? Well, a very popular book in our church, one that I bought and started to read. I had to stop at page 15 because even though people love the book, and I'm sure it's a great book, the writer says the old covenant is man demonstrating what he can do for God, while the new covenant, which is the New Testament, is what is God demonstrating what he can do for and through man. I just had to stop. I just put the book down. I thought the Old Testament is for what man can do for God. But that would make the God of the Old Testament different from the God of the New Testament, wouldn't it? Is there grace in the law? Oh, yeah. Quick step back. Most of us know this, so I'm going to be fast. There are two Greek verb moods, the indicative, what's true, the imperative, sit down, be quiet, eat more, you know, those commands, right? So forgive one another, forgive each other as Christ has forgiven you. New Testament common verse, it has an indicative and an imperative. The indicative, Christ has already forgiven you. Therefore, forgive each other. But if you notice, the word therefore isn't in the text, is it? But that's the logical transition. Christ has forgiven you for everything. Therefore, it would make sense that you forgive your wife for burning your dinner, for, you know, even the horrific things, because Christ has forgiven everything for you, right? So that therefore is an implied logical connector. The imperative is a logical response to the truth, the indicative truth that God has already initiated. Well, there is no indicative and imperative verb modes in the Hebrew. However, there is this idea of God God initiating, and therefore we respond in a logical manner. And that's what you find all over in the book of Deuteronomy. So open up your Bibles. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 6. All right. Someone can read that in any translation they would like. Nice and loud, though, with gusto. How about? You can read the next one. All right. What is this? This is an indicative statement, right? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Israel. Now, just that alone, if you were to write an essay on what that means, what does it mean that God brought them out of Israel or Egypt? What do we learn about God just from that statement? He's a provider. He's a protector. He's powerful. He's visionary. There is no other God that can defeat him. He is unequaled, right? He's all that and more. That would be an indicative statement. All right? Would you read verse 7 nice and loud?
You shall have no other gods before me.
Beautiful. What's that? That's an imperative. What's missing? Therefore, right? Because I am the God who brought you out of Egypt, it makes sense then that you would have no other God before me. See what I'm saying? Indicative, imperative. And that's even a Ten Commandment, right? There's grace even in the Ten Commandments. How cool is that? That's really cool. God always initiates with us before he asks a logical response from us. God always initiates before he asks us to do a logical response. Isn't that grace? That was last time I checked. That was grace. Chapters 5 through 11, it's all over. There's a theme because of who God is. We love and obey him for our own good. That's New Testament, right? Be anxious for nothing, command, but in everything with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, there's the implied indicative, we have a lot to be thankful for from God. Let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your mind and heart in Christ Jesus. Outcome, right? It was with your own eyes that you saw all the great things the Lord has done. Indicative. Observe, therefore, all the commands I'm giving you today. Why wouldn't you, if God is so good and so loving, so that you may live long in the land flowing with milk and honey? Right? God's initiative, Israel's response, and an outcome. I know there's a lot of differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament, but isn't that kind of the same for us New Testament Christians? God initiates. It's illogical not to respond back in love. And there's a blessing for us, isn't there? It's the same way in the book of Deuteronomy. It's the same way in the Old Testament. So, let me summarize this section of grace. There's a whole lot more, believe me. I reined myself in. The detailed requirements of God on Israel, the laws, chapter 12 through 26, are all founded upon the grace of God manifested in their history, chapters 1 through 11. Chapters 1 through 11 is a whole narrative of God's grace, choosing Israel, going after Israel, loving Israel, protecting Israel, feeding Israel, redeeming Israel, disciplining Israel, that's love, and giving Israel the land that they didn't earn. That's all about grace. The very meaning of the law the fathers are to give to inquiring children is nothing less than a narrative of redemption. Isn't that your story, if you know Jesus Christ? Don't you have a story of redemption? Right, I do. The priority of saving grace is as much a principle of Old Testament ethics as New Testament theology. Law is in the Old Testament, grace is in the New. Yeah, there's law in the Old Testament, but there's plenty of grace. In fact, there's grace in the law, because never did God ever ask us to respond unless he first initiated. All right, so then we move into God's priorities. We get into the laws. How many of you have read Deuteronomy and you were really troubled by the laws? Come on, be honest. Of course you were. First of all, if you ever do decide to go back and read it, let me recommend the NIV Study Bible, not the Life Application Bible or the Inductive Study Bible. But the New International Version Study Bible is the best text for all of the little questions that readers have, because the notes in Deuteronomy are amazing. All right, the notes in the Old Testament are great. A lot of times I read first Deuteronomy with the New American Standard Bible as is, and I had a lot of questions. And then I got the new International Version Study Bible with all the notes for Deuteronomy. Whoops, my maps are. Anyways. I really recommend that you use the NIV Study Bible, because you won't get stuck with all those, I don't understand this law. There's some great explanations in the New International Version Study. But you know, some of the laws are troubling. But if you're able to get through them with a couple ideas, number one, you're reading this from a 21st century sensibility. Right, that they were primitive, but God worked within the broken society, the broken world, the fall of humanity, and so he allowed people to, he kept a lot of times people within the social status that they were put into, but always protecting them. But I think we read these, especially us women, we read these like, oh, I just can't believe this, but we're really reading this from a 21st century situation, from an urban, non-agricultural perspective of the 21st century, where a lot of things have changed. But if you read these laws, you're going to find out that God has some pretty clear priorities. And the Ten Commandments actually follow, where God is first. A heart love, a heart loyalty to God is first, then people would come second. And the laws about society and family, life, sexual conduct are all really important to God, and then property is last. In fact, the commentary that I read says, you know, when we, and William Lane Craig said this so in so many words, when you take God out of the equation, then you reverse the priorities. Property is more important than people, right? And that's very true. I did a survey of ancient Near Eastern law codes about 10 years ago. I didn't know I was an egghead. I'm like, oh, these are really cool. But I did a survey, and I found, as I read Deuteronomy with other A&E law codes, including the Code of Hammurabi, there is no capital punishment in Deuteronomy for crimes against property. None. If you steal, there's restitution, pay up. There's no jail time, pay up, which I think makes sense. But there's an expanded capital punishment for crimes against humanity. Kidnapping was a capital offense in the Book of Deuteronomy, and not just for male children like in the Code of Hammurabi, but for female children as well. I mean, again, what God was giving the nation of Israel as a group of laws far, far outshone anything that the ancient Near Eastern culture surrounding Israel would have, because God wasn't their God. So there's an expanded list of capital crimes. I know you're wondering about the disobedient son who gets stoned, right? That's not fair, right? I would have been, you know, dead early on. But again, you read those, and it's the son who was to take over the patriarchal role of the family. It was the son who said, I don't want to care for my family. And that was worthy of capital punishment. He just wasn't, you know, having a bad day and sassed off. He was completely, you know, giving away his role as the provider that God wanted him to be. But it's interesting to note that as you read the other ancient Near Eastern law codes, you've got lots of crimes against property, capital crimes against property for the rich people, but there's none in the Old Testament. Why? Because God doesn't value property as highly as he values people. And yet, as you read the book of Deuteronomy, he really, really values people. He values the sanctity of marriage. He values the sanctity of family and of life. So the laws are in chapters 12 through 26. And as you read them, you find out that there are a few themes that run through it. First of all, generosity. God wanted his people to be generous. Back in Exodus chapter 19, to the first generation, God says through Moses to the nation of Israel, I've rescued you, and now if you obey my commandments, you will be to me a priesthood, a royal priesthood, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. Does that sound familiar? Where have I heard that before? 1 Peter 2:9. That's in the New Testament. How can that be? Because God's the same in the Old Testament and the New Testament. But he had chosen them to be a kingdom of priests. In other words, Israel was to be the intermediary between humanity and him, but also a holy nation, which is a word for distinct, a different nation like God. And so these laws are going to represent what it means to be holy, to be distinct, to represent God on a very daily basis. And so you see that God wanted the nation of Israel to be generous. They were only to glean their fields once. They were to liberally supply freed slaves. Here, take a whole bunch of stuff with you from my cupboards as you go. You know, I've got host people here, and I'm like, here's a couple bananas. Don't take them all, right? It's like, that's hard to be that generous, right? They're saying, here, take a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, you can have them, really. I'm okay. I let it go. The Sabbath and Jubilee years for lands and debts. You owe me $1,000? Yeah, don't worry about it. Now, how could people do that in Israel? What would they need? Okay, I grow green beans, and every time I look for every single green bean, because they're mine, I think about this first verse. How could I just let them go once? What would I need to really obey this? I would have to have a love, trust, relationship with God to obey Him. Wait a minute. That's the New Testament, isn't it? Right? How am I going to obey God? I'm going to trust Him. To do these things, they had to have a love relationship with God. And they could, generally speaking. He cared about justice. The poor were not to be let off the hook because they were poor, and the rich were not to be let off the hook because they were rich. There was supposed to be fair and equitable justice. And there was to be protected personhood. So, for example, women were not to be taken advantage of within, their subordinate status in society. Women were still subordinated. They couldn't go out and get jobs like us. They didn't have colleges back then. There's a whole lot that's different, and we cannot read the laws straight through a 21st century feminist perspective. It's just not going to work. But as you do look, you see, wow, God was really out to protect these women. You think the Hittite women were getting any protection in their laws? I went out with this guy before I was married. Oh, poor guy. I don't know how he started talking about it. He goes, you know, that the laws in Deuteronomy were horribly oppressive to women. I go, really? That was our last date. He didn't know. He had read something. He had heard, watched History Channel, whatever. You know, when you pit these against what the other ancient Near Eastern cultures were doing to their women, God was amazingly protective to these women. Do I understand all the laws? No. Do some still trouble me? Yes. But am I satisfied that the good God who brought them out of Egypt and gave them the land could give them a constitution that if they obeyed generally, they would have blessings and life? Yeah. There's just a lot I just don't quite know, because it's about 3,500 years ago, right? All right. So, you doing okay? What do we do with the laws? Well, we don't have to obey them. Do not raise your right hand. I promise I won't leave this saying, Kathy said I had to do the Old Testament laws. You don't have to obey them. Do you have to obey Iran's laws? No, you're not a citizen of Iran. Do you have to obey Mexico's laws today? No, you're not in Mexico, right? We're not citizens of ancient Israel. We do not have to obey the laws. Does that make you feel better? Were you afraid I was going to make you glean your fields only once? Were you afraid I was going to make you plant something, right? No, you don't have to obey them. We're New Testament Christians. We're not in a theocracy. The old ancient Israel is gone. So what do we do with them? Should we just not read them? Well, I think I started to get serious about this when I started to read. How many of you like Psalms? How many of you like what David has to say? Oh, I love the law. The law brings me life. The law is like what? Gold and honey, and the law is the bomb. And I'm like, well, was David just stupid? Was he ignorant? Was he primitive? How did David find life in the law? And that's what got me really thinking about what do we do with them? I'm not quite sure. And there are theologians who will go to war over this. Okay? So I'm not a theologian. I'm just an ordinary girl who somehow loved this book. But I'm gonna go with what a lot of people are doing now. Tim Keller, if you read his Generous Justice book, so has anyone ever read that? It's all out of Deuteronomy. It's interpreting them with what's called principalism. In other words, identify what a law meant to the initial audience, if you can. That's why the study notes really help. Determine differences between the initial audience and the believers today. So gleaning the fields. Are we an agricultural society? No. Right? develop universal principles from the text. What is God trying to do here? Who is he trying to protect or promote? Whose power is he trying to restrict or increase? Things like that. What is closest to God's heart here? Well, I think it's generosity and being content with what I have because he's going to provide for me, or excuse me, for them. You know, I think that's the general idea. Correlate the principle with the New Testament teaching. Can you find anything in the New Testament about being generous? Yes. How about being satisfied with what you have? Yes. I mean, shoot it. See, there's even a prayer in Proverbs. So if you want to just leave the law and go right into Proverbs, right? Lord, grant that I may not have too much or too little, right? Just give me what I need, right? So I don't steal and profane your name or get rich and forget you, right? So you don't even have to leave the Old Testament to use a principle that you would use, right? And then apply the modified principle today. What does it mean for me to glean my fields? What does it mean for me to be generous? What does it mean for you? It might be different for me. That's that love relationship with our shepherd. He's taught me from Deuteronomy to not be so greedy. He's taught me to be more generous. He's taught me to live, honestly, I live more simply now because of Deuteronomy. You don't have to buy all your clothes at thrift stores, recycle your rainwater, whatever you want to do. You know, I do. That's just me. I want to live more simply so that others can, I can be generous with what God has given me, right? You cannot have any of my green beans, though. They're still mine. We can do this, and this is what the general idea is for the book of Deuteronomy. So, let me conclude with laws in the Old Testament, graces in the New. True? I did it wrong. Animation. All right, not true. Not true, and not true. But that's really for you to get in the book and decide. Deuteronomy is the portal to the rest of the Old Testament. If you can understand Deuteronomy, you can understand the rest of the Old Testament, because the rest of the Old Testament is the Israelites being unfaithful to God, God going after them over and over again with his prophets, and the curses that you read about happen in later books. And so when there's a drought, the Israelites were not to wonder, why is it not raining for 3 years? Well, just go back to the covenant that you made with God. So everything flows from Deuteronomy. Two books that have been extremely helpful for me: the New International Biblical Commentary by Christopher Wright. So readable. Literally, it can be read like a novel or a bedtime story. It's really, really accessible. Wonderful. And then Ajith Fernando, who was at our Summer Institute a few years ago, did an inductive study of the entire book of Deuteronomy. I didn't even think I could do that. And then this has a lot of personal reflections, a lot of applications. It's easier to read. He quotes Wright a lot, so I felt comfortable. And so if you could do a whole teaching series with some stuff from even this book too. So up here is my bibliography. I'm going to end now, and I'm going to open it up for a few minutes of questions. I'm not an expert, but I'll do my best. I'll either make it up and then I'll start laughing so you know I'm lying, or I'll say I don't know. Yeah. Can you give me an example?
Yeah, that was something that at an earlier session, an atheist brought up, that like, since the moral laws don't apply then, or don't apply now, and that morality has been evolving.
Right.
And hasn't been like a concrete.
Well, I don't think morality has evolved, because I think, again, the principles, what's close to God's heart in the Old Testament shows up in the New Testament. I could literally live a holy life, this distinctly different life representing God to my neighbors, and never read the Old Testament, because the principles of the Old Testament are in the New Testament. So I don't think they've evolved. That was, what is a farmer in Israel to do with his land if he wants to be a follower of God? I'm an urban, you know, person. So but the principles, I think that's the beauty of the unity of the Bible. The principles remain the same. So I don't think it's relativism. Are the devils in the detail even for us now as New Testament Christians? How to really love God with our heart and what that looks like even in the United States? It's hard. And we've got gray areas that we can operate in based on our consciences. But some of the, you know, the morality is the same. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was curious if you studied also the other, like, laws around, like, not only in the ancient Near East, but also, like, in, like, the, like, entirety of the ancient world. That would be really nerdy. But I would be really happy that you did it.
I'd be happy that you'd do it and you'd send me the report.
Okay.
No, I don't want to know. Thank you. But it does sound interesting.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this stuff is accessible. That's what's so cool about being in a digital age. You know, it wasn't hard to pull up ancient Near Eastern information. So, yeah.
I just want to clarify to make sure that I heard you correctly. When we were talking about imperatives and indicatives, were you stating that there will always be an indicative that an imperative is followed by the
indicative? Always.
It never be like just, well, I guess there could be an indicative just stated there, but if there's an imperative, there has to be an indicative.
Right. It may not be explicit, i.e. it may not be said in the text. Mm-hmm. The book of James is almost all commands. Mm-hmm. You've got to go induce the indicatives, the truths about God that aren't there.
So
may not be there. But it's never us obeying God and then God doing something second. It's always, I mean, the cross of Christ is enough to be the great indicative of our lives, right? But there's always an indicative. My friend here always taught me that in the book of James, you know, James is being written to a group of Jewish followers of Christ now. And he's basically saying, you want to be a good Christ follower, go back and be a good Jew. Because most of what you read in James is out of the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, right? Be good to the orphans and widows, don't take bribes. You know, there's a lot, the gap is not as wide as we think it is, but never in either Testament do we obey first and then God bless, you know, God do something for us next. It's always based on God doing something first. Yeah.
I like your point that Deuteronomy is kind of like an entrance to the rest of the Old Testament, and it got me thinking of really the only example I guess that would come to mind, but in the book of Daniel where we get a real famous prophecy chapter 9 about the Messiah entering Jerusalem and being cut off or killed. That whole prophecy is given in the context of the Israelites having broken very crucial laws from Deuteronomy, that they would that they would skip every seventh year
right. In
agriculture and trust that God would provide for them.
Right.
And so I think it's interesting to kind of think about that in the context of what you're saying, that there's grace upon grace in the law. They're given this law, don't have a Sabbath year
mm-hmm.
in which I will provide for you. You don't mm-hmm. have to work, trust me, I'll
mm-hmm.
love you.
Right.
When they break it, they get sent to exile where they can be re-taught that God's going to provide for them.
Right.
It's in that context that they're in exile.
Right.
Daniel's praying, when we get out,
right. The
angel comes and says, here's when you get out, by the way, now I'm going to use the really cool info about this song.
Yeah.
So it's really cool to see how we can read it and just totally miss all the cool details of God working through
right.
Right.
Excellent. We also, there's a whole lot about the historical context that we don't always know. Ancient Near Eastern cultures believe that the seventh day, because of the moon, was an evil day. The 7th, 14th, 21st, and 28th days were evil days in the calendar. And those are the days that the ancient Near Eastern cultures had to appease their gods. So how cool is it, see goosebumps, that God's like, you know what, take the day off. You don't have to appease me. I'll take care of you. Okay, see, context there's a lot of context that, you know, you hear people say, well, the God of the Old Testament is different. Well, there's a lot of context that they don't know. So I encourage you, don't be afraid of the Old Testament. Start in Deuteronomy. Go into some of the minor prophets and understand that, you know, God was really taking the priests and the prophets and the kings on. It was the leaders that he had his harshest rebukes for. Enjoy the Old Testament. See what is close to God's heart. And I think you'll really be able then to defend the Bible in its entirety because you will have done the reading and the thinking and the meditating yourself. So I've left it's so hot in here. Thank you for hanging in there. I've left out the worksheets. I'll put my email on the board if you'd like me to send you my PowerPoint if that's not enough. And I'll stay for questions if you have any. But thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.